A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about the big question. What gives a life meaning? And here's the twist he wants us to pull apart. When people answer that question, they're usually reaching for one of two very different things. Either they want to leave a legacy, to be remembered, to carve their name somewhere in the record, or they want to make an impact, to change something for the better, whether anyone knows it was them or not. And he's asking whether most of us even have an elevator pitch for our own existence, or if we're just living inside scripts we never stop to examine.
Can you state in 30 seconds what your life is actually for? Most people can't. There was a Pew study in 2024. Only 28% of Americans said they have a clear sense of purpose they can articulate. That means nearly 3/4 of people are, at best, improvising.
Which, to be fair, describes most of human history. But here's where it gets sharp. The two answers people give when they do try to answer. Legacy and impact. They sound like synonyms. They get mashed together constantly. But they're operating on completely different logic. Legacy is backward-looking. It's reputational. It asks, who will remember me? Impact is forward-looking. It's consequentialist. It asks, what will be different because I was here?
The distinction matters enormously because the framework you choose reshapes every decision downstream. If you're legacy-driven, you need visibility. You need a story that outlives you. If you're impact-driven, you might work in total obscurity and be completely satisfied.
The silent contributor who changes everything and nobody knows their name, versus the person who builds a monument to themselves that does nothing for anyone.
And the uncomfortable question lurking underneath all of this. And I think this is why the prompt lands hard right now, in mid-2026, is whether the anxiety people feel about their lives adding up to something is actually getting worse. We're living through a moment where existential risks are front page material. Climate trajectory, AI alignment, the sense that the future is fragile. And at the same time, we've got this optimization culture. Quantify everything, measure your steps, track your productivity, calculate your impact. It's a recipe for a kind of purpose. Panic.
That's the phrase. Everyone's suddenly worried their life doesn't have a tight enough elevator pitch, and the dashboard says they're behind on their meaning metrics.
The dashboard is the problem, not the solution. But we'll get to that.
The prompt is really three questions folded together. One, how do different religious and philosophical traditions handle this legacy versus impact distinction? Two, why do we keep conflating them? And three, how many people are actually living with a coherent answer to the purpose question versus just not asking it at all?
That last one might be the most important, the meta question. Because before you can debate legacy versus impact, you have to notice that you're even operating inside a framework. Most people inherit their purpose from their surroundings, career, family, accumulation, and never crack it open to see what's inside.
The unexamined life. But make it a quarterly performance review.
And here's what makes this worth our time. The traditions we're going to walk through. Greek, Hindu, Buddhist, Confucian, Jewish, Christian, Islamic, Enlightenment. They've all wrestled with this exact tension. It's not new. Alexander the Great weeping at Achilles' tomb because he hadn't achieved enough glory yet. That's the legacy seeker in its purest form. And then you've got the Bodhisattva vow in Mahayana Buddhism, delaying your own enlightenment to help every other sentient being reach theirs first. Pure impact, zero personal credit. The tension is ancient.
The fact that it's ancient doesn't make it settled. If anything, we've just gotten better at confusing ourselves about it. The modern version of Alexander weeping at a tomb is someone refreshing their citation count.
Or checking their follower numbers. Same impulse, different metrics.
Where do we start untangling this?
I think we start by getting the two poles really clear, because most people use legacy and impact interchangeably, and they're not. They operate on different timescales, different ego involvement levels, different theories of what makes a life worth living. Once we've got that distinction sharp, we can walk through how the traditions handled it, and then we can get to the really uncomfortable part, which is whether you can actually separate them in practice.
The elevator pitch test is the spine here. If you had to stand up and say, in 30 seconds, what your life is for, would your answer be about who remembers you, or about what changes because you existed? Most people have never asked themselves that question. And the answer, when you actually sit with it, is more revealing than people expect.
Let's define the two poles properly. Legacy is a backward-looking game. It's reputational. The question is, who will remember me, and for what? It's inherently social. You can't have a legacy without an audience. Some future person has to know your name, or at least know you existed.
The marble bust in the town square, the name chair at the university, the Wikipedia page.
An impact is a forward-looking game. It's consequentialist. The question is, what will be different in the world because I existed? And crucially, it doesn't require anyone to know it was you. Impact can be completely anonymous. The person who invents a better irrigation method that saves a village from drought. If nobody records their name, the impact still happened.
Legacy is about the signal. Impact is about the signal's effect. You can have impact without legacy, and you can chase legacy without having any real impact. The politician who builds a library in their own name but never actually funded the books.
That's the empty legacy. And you can have both, obviously. Someone like Jonas Salk refusing to patent the polio vaccine. Massive impact, and he's remembered for it. But the frameworks are distinct, and they pull you in different directions when you're making decisions. Do you take the visible role or the effective one? Do you spend time documenting your work or doing more of it?
Here's why the conflation happens, I think. Both are responses to the same underlying terror, that your existence is finite and might not matter. Legacy and impact are two different ways of saying, I was here and it counted. They're both answers to death, but one answer requires an audience and the other doesn't.
That's the psychological mechanism right there, and it's why the elevator pitch test is so revealing. If you actually sit down and write a 30-second statement of purpose, the language you reach for will betray which framework you're operating from. Are you using words like remembered, known for, left behind? That's legacy. Are you using words like changed, improved, built, solved? That's impact. Most people have never done this exercise, which is remarkable when you think about it. The single biggest question a human can ask, and we don't teach anyone how to answer it.
We teach people how to write elevator pitches for startups, for job interviews, for networking events, but not for the thing.
The 28% number from Pew? That's not 28% who have a purpose. It's 28% who say they can articulate one clearly. The actual number of people living with a coherent framework is probably lower. The rest are what the prompt calls living inside inherited scripts.
Career, family, accumulation, the three defaults. Get the job, raise the kids, buy the house. None of those are bad. They're actually quite good, but they're scripts. They're what society hands you when you don't ask the question yourself.
The scripts work for a while. They keep you busy enough that you don't notice you've never answered the underlying question. Until something breaks, a layoff, an empty nest, a health scare, and suddenly the script stops running and you're standing there with no elevator pitch and a lot of silence.
Which is the moment people often scramble toward legacy projects. The midlife memoir, the desperate attempt to matter before the clock runs out.
Or they discover impact work late. Second careers in teaching, volunteering, the stuff they should have been doing all along. The question the prompt is really driving at is why so few people ask this before the crisis hits. Why the unexamined life is still the default, 24 centuries after Socrates told us it wasn't worth living.
Because asking the question is uncomfortable. If you actually sit down and write the elevator pitch for your existence, you might discover you don't like the answer, or that you don't have one, or that the one you've been living by is borrowed from your parents, or your culture, or your fear of being forgotten. That's not a Tuesday afternoon exercise most people are eager to do.
Yet the traditions we're about to walk through, they all start with exactly that discomfort. Every single one of them begins by saying, stop, look at your life, ask what it's for. The answers are wildly different, but the starting point is the same. So let's trace how they handled this legacy impact split, because they saw it long before we gave it those names. Let's start with the Greeks, because they basically invented this tension for the Western mind. You've got two competing visions of the good life sitting right next to each other in the same culture. On one side, Homeric Kleos, Kleos glory, immortal fame, the thing Achilles chooses when he stays at Troy knowing it'll kill him. He literally trades his life for a story that will be sung forever.
The ultimate legacy play. Die young. Leave a good-looking corpse. Get an epic poem.
On the other side, barely a few centuries later, you've got Aristotle saying, the point of life is eudaimonia, human flourishing through virtue, not being remembered. And the audience for that excellence isn't future generations. Your own rational nature.
Aristotle's version of the elevator pitch would be something like, I lived in accordance with reason and cultivated virtue. No mention of anyone remembering it.
And that's a radical break. The Homeric hero needs witnesses. The Aristotelian virtuous person needs only their own character. The legacy is incidental, if it comes at all.
Which makes Alexander the Great the perfect case study in which one actually won. He carries a copy of Aristotle's works, his tutor, but he weeps at Achilles' tomb because he hasn't achieved enough Kleos. The student of virtue philosophy, emotionally wrecked because his glory metrics aren't where he wants them.
Alexander is the original legacy impact collision in one person. He changed the world. Massive impact, the Hellenistic period reshaped three continents. But by every account, what drove him was being remembered. The impact was almost a side effect of the legacy pursuit.
Now flip east. The Bhagavad Gita gives us something that feels like it was written specifically to answer Alexander's problem.
Action without attachment to results. Krishna tells Arjuna, you're a warrior, you have to fight, but your duty is to the action itself, not to the fruits of the action. Don't do it for glory. Don't do it for legacy. Do it because it's the right action, and then let it go.
Which is impact without ego. Pure, forward-looking consequentialism with the self completely removed from the equation. It's almost impossible to actually do, but as a framework, it's the cleanest rejection of legacy seeking I know of.
It's roughly 2,000 years old. This isn't a modern insight. The Gita saw that attachment to outcomes, including the outcome of being remembered, is a trap. It binds you to the cycle of suffering. The only way out is to act rightly and release any claim on what happens next, including whether anyone knows your name.
Compare that to the Confucian tradition, which goes almost the opposite direction. Filial piety, ancestral veneration, the continuity of the family name. That's legacy as duty. Your purpose is to honor those who came before and be honored by those who come after. The elevator pitch is, I maintain the line.
It's not vanity in the Confucian framework, it's obligation. You owe your ancestors remembrance, and you owe your descendants a name they can be proud of. Legacy isn't a personal indulgence. It's the glue that holds society together across generations.
You got the Gita saying detach from results entirely, and Confucius saying your results are your family's continuity. Take that seriously. Two completely different answers to the same question.
Then the Abrahamic traditions add another layer. Judaism's Tikkun Olam, repairing the world, that's an impact framework. You're here to fix what's broken. But it's got a communal dimension that pure individual impact doesn't. You're repairing the world as part of a people, across generations. Your individual contribution matters, but it's not about your name.
The collective legacy softens the ego problem. We repaired the world, rather than I repaired the world.
Christianity takes a different turn. Store up treasures in heaven, where moth and rust do not destroy. That's a radical reframing of the audience. You're not seeking impact for its earthly effects, and you're definitely not seeking legacy in human memory. You're performing for an audience of one. The impact is real, but it's measured on a completely different ledger.
Which solves the vanity problem by removing the human audience entirely. You can't perform for the gallery if the gallery is God and only God sees the real score.
Then Islam gives us this fascinating bridge concept, sadaqah jariya, ongoing charity. It's charity that continues to benefit people after you die. A well you dig, a school you build, knowledge you pass on. It's impact because people's lives are improved. But it's also legacy because the ongoing reward accrues to you in the afterlife. The two frameworks are explicitly merged.
Islam just admits what the other traditions dance around, that maybe you can't fully separate them, and maybe you shouldn't try. Build the well. Let it be in your name. The impact is real, and the legacy is permissible.
Which brings us to the Enlightenment, where things get weird. Kant's categorical imperative, act only according to that maxim whereby you can at the same time will that it should become a universal law. That's impact without any personal legacy at all. Your actions should be universalizable. Whether anyone remembers you is irrelevant. The moral law is the point.
The most Prussian elevator pitch imaginable. I acted such that my actions could be willed as universal law. No name, no face, just the principle.
Then Hegel comes along and says, actually, history itself is the tribunal. Great individuals shape the world spirit, and they are remembered precisely because they moved history forward. The cunning of reason works through ambitious, legacy-driven people who don't even know they're serving a larger purpose.
Hegel rehabilitates the Alexander model. The glory seeker is actually doing the work of history, whether he understands it or not. Legacy and impact collapse back into each other.
That's where the modern, secular tension crystallizes. We inherited Kant's universalism and Hegel's historicism simultaneously. We want our actions to be morally pure and universally valid, but we also want to matter in the story of humanity. We want to be both the anonymous moral agent and the remembered historical actor. And those two desires pull in opposite directions.
Which is exactly the knot the prompt is asking us to untie. Every tradition we just walked through saw the tension. None of them fully resolved it. And we're walking around with all of them rattling around in our heads at once.
We've got all these traditions rattling around, and none of them fully settled the tension. But here's where it gets psychological. And I think this is the mechanism underneath everything we've been describing. In 1986, three researchers, Greenberg, Pacinski, and Solomon, published terror management theory. The basic idea is that humans are uniquely aware of their own mortality, and that awareness creates paralyzing existential terror. So we build psychological buffers. Cultural worldviews, self-esteem, and crucially, the belief that we'll somehow persist beyond death, either literally through afterlife beliefs or symbolically through legacy.
Legacy seeking isn't just vanity, it's a death. Anxiety coping mechanism. Your name lives on, so you don't really die.
That's the theory. But here's where it gets interesting. A 2023 analysis of terror management research found something that maps almost perfectly onto our legacy impact split. Legacy motives, wanting to be remembered, they do reduce death anxiety. People who believe they'll leave a lasting name are less terrified of mortality. But legacy motives do not predict life satisfaction. They calm the fear, but they don't make you happy.
The bust in the town square helps you sleep at night, but it doesn't make the mornings any better.
Impact motives, on the other hand, the belief that your actions made a real difference, those predict both reduced death anxiety and increased life satisfaction. The people who feel they've changed something for the better are less afraid of dying and more content while they're alive.
Which suggests the silent contributor is actually winning. Psychologically, the person who just does the work and doesn't worry about who remembers gets the full package. The legacy chaser gets the anxiety relief, but misses the satisfaction.
That brings us to the modern trap, because we built an entire culture that seems designed to make this worse. The quantified self. We've turned purpose into a dashboard. Steps walked, hours tracked, impact metrics calculated. There was a book last year, Lila Chen's The Metric of Meaning, that made the argument that all these impact measurement tools, the whole effective altruism apparatus of how many lives did you save, it's really just legacy seeking and quantitative drag.
The dashboard becomes the new audience. You're not performing for future historians, you're performing for the spreadsheet.
The spreadsheet never stops watching. It's worse than the Homeric bard. At least the bard only sings about you after you're dead. The dashboard gives you real-time feedback on whether you're mattering enough.
Which is how you get purpose. Panic. The number's never high enough. Someone else saved more lives, walked more steps, had more impact. The comparison is infinite and immediate.
Take effective altruism as a case study. William McCaskill's long-termism, the idea that impacting future generations is the highest moral priority, that we should be thinking about trillions of potential lives. On its face, that's the ultimate impact framework. You're making decisions based on consequences that will ripple forward for millions of years. Your name is irrelevant. Yet there was this fascinating internal debate at Open Philanthropy last year in 2024. The question on the table was whether cause prioritization, the whole methodology of deciding which problems matter most, is actually a purpose framework or just a methodology. Are people drawn to effective altruism because they genuinely want to maximize impact, or because being the person who saved the future is the most sophisticated legacy play ever devised?
wanting to be the person who saved the future. That's legacy with a trillion-year time horizon.
You can't prove it's not. That's the problem. The long-termist can always say, no, I don't care if anyone remembers my name, I just want the future to be better. And maybe they mean it. But the structure of the thing, the conferences, the books, the named positions, the public debates about who's doing long-termism correctly, it looks an awful lot like a legacy economy.
The Wikipedia editor who made 2 million edits anonymously. That person is the control group. 2 million edits, zero name recognition, no conference invitations, no book deals. Just the work.
We don't know their name. That's pure impact with zero legacy. And here's the uncomfortable question. Why does our culture valorize the visible impact maker? The Musk, the Gates, the McCaskill, over the invisible one. The nurse who worked 40 years in a neonatal unit. The infrastructure engineer who maintained a city's water system. The teacher who taught 3,000 kids to read.
Because the visible ones are better stories. A silent contributor doesn't make a good TED Talk.
Yet the data says the silent contributors might be the ones who actually have it figured out. There was a 2022 study of what they called high-impact professionals. Doctors, engineers, people whose work demonstrably improves lives. 73% said they would continue their work even if no one ever knew about it. Not even if they weren't paid. Even if no one knew.
That's the number that should make the legacy seeker pause. 3/4 of the people actually doing the most good would keep doing it in total anonymity. The work itself is the point.
Which brings us to the giving pledge. Billionaires publicly committing to give away most of their wealth. Is that legacy or impact? That's the problem. It's both. And it's impossible to untangle. The 2025 controversy was revealing. Researchers found that a significant number of signatories hadn't actually changed their giving behavior. They were already planning to give that money. The pledge just made it public.
The pledge itself is the legacy play. The giving was already happening. The announcement is the part that's for the audience.
That's where I start to think the distinction might be a false one in practice. Not in theory. The theory holds. Legacy is backward-looking and reputational, impact is forward-looking and consequentialist. But in a human life, the two are so tangled that pulling them apart might be like separating the dancer from the dance.
The elevator pitch test still works, though. Even if the two are tangled in practice, the language you reach for when you describe your purpose tells you which one is actually driving the bus. I want to be remembered for versus I want to change.
If your answer is the second one, the next question is, would you still do it if the change happened, but your name was erased from every record? If the answer is yes, you're impact-driven. If the answer is no, if the anonymity makes the whole enterprise feel hollow, then legacy was in the driver's seat the whole time, and you just didn't know it.
That's the uncomfortable conclusion. Most of us don't actually know which one we're chasing until we imagine the anonymity test, and a lot of people who think they're impact-driven discover they're not.
Let's turn this into something usable. The first one's the elevator pitch test we've been orbiting around. Actually, sit down, write a 30-second statement of what your life is for. Not your job description, not your roles, husband, father, employee, but the purpose those roles serve. Then read it back and ask, is this about being remembered or about changing something?
The language will snitch on you. If the verbs are known for, remembered as, left behind, you're in legacy territory. If they're built, fixed, taught, improved, that's impact. Neither is wrong, but you should at least know which one you're running.
Most people, when they actually do this, discover they've never made the choice consciously. They absorbed a framework from somewhere, and it's been steering the ship ever since.
The second exercise is the one that stings. The anonymous impact thought experiment. Picture the most meaningful work you could do. The thing that would make you feel like your existence justified itself. Now imagine you do it, perfectly, and it changes everything it's supposed to change. But your name is erased from every record. Nobody knows it was you. No gratitude, no memory, no Wikipedia page. Do you still do it?
If the answer is yes, you're impact-driven. If the answer is no, if the anonymity hollows out the whole thing, then legacy was in the driver's seat. And that's fine, but you should know that about yourself. Because if you're legacy-driven and you keep taking impact-driven jobs, you're going to feel invisible and resentful and you won't understand why.
The silent contributor, who's actually a frustrated legacy seeker, is a very specific kind of miserable.
It's preventable if you just ask the question. The third exercise borrows from two traditions that don't usually share a sentence. Marcus Aurelius, the Stoic view from above. Imagine yourself from a great height. See how small your life is against the scale of time and space. That's the ego shrinker. It's brutal but clarifying.
You are a speck on a speck. Your legacy is a ripple in a puddle in a universe that won't remember any of this.
Then, counterbalance it with the Jewish concept of l'dor v'dor from generation to generation. The idea that your impact isn't supposed to be visible in your lifetime or even in your children's. You're laying bricks in a wall you'll never see completed. The work matters, but the timeline is longer than your ego wants it to be.
The Stoic view from above says, you're tiny, get over yourself. And l'dor v'dor says, your tiny contribution is real. It just doesn't need your name on it, and it might not flower for a century.
Hold those two in tension, and the whole legacy versus impact anxiety starts to loosen. You're not supposed to see the full arc. You're not supposed to be remembered. You're supposed to do the work and pass it forward.
Which, if we're being honest, is what the Bhagavad Gita was saying 2 millennia ago. Detach from the fruits. Do the action. Let it go.
The ancients keep winning. We've walked through 3,000 years of philosophy and psychology, and the answer, if I'm being honest, is that the distinction between legacy and impact might ultimately be a false dichotomy. Not useless. The framework clarifies things. But false in the sense that at the deepest level, both might be expressions of the same underlying drive.
We want our existence to have a shape that outlasts us. Whether that shape is a name carved in stone or a changed world with no signature on it, either way, we're trying to leave a structure behind that says someone was here.
That drive might be more fundamental than either legacy or impact. We're pattern-seeking creatures who know we're going to die. The terror isn't just that we'll stop existing, it's that our existence might have no structure, no arc, no narrative that continues. Legacy and impact are just two different narrative forms.
The epic poem versus the quiet novel. One has a named hero, the other just has consequences that ripple through characters who never know the source.
Here's where this gets strange to think about, because the ground is shifting under the whole question. We're maybe a decade away from technologies that completely scramble what legacy and impact even mean. Digital twins, mind uploading, AI simulations of deceased people, the things that used to be science fiction are in active research programs right now.
If you can be remembered forever as a simulation, if your great-grandchildren can have conversations with a digital version of you that learned your mannerisms and memories, what does legacy even mean at that point? It's not a marble bust anymore. It's a chatbot with your personality.
Does that inflate legacy to infinite proportions, or does it make it meaningless? If everyone can be digitally preserved, then being remembered stops being an achievement and becomes a default. Immortality as a service, $12.99 a month.
The subscription model for the afterlife. That's the most depressing thing I've heard all episode.
It forces the question. If legacy becomes cheap, if digital persistence is just something that happens to everyone, does impact become the only thing that actually differentiates a life? Or does impact also get weird when you can simulate a version of someone who keeps doing good forever?
I think it makes the elevator pitch more important, not less. Because when the technology can simulate your face, your voice, your mannerisms, the one thing it can't simulate is the actual choice you made about what your life was for. The purpose wasn't the output. The purpose was the choosing.
That's the final pitch, I think. The elevator pitch for your life doesn't need to be perfect. It doesn't need to be philosophically airtight. It doesn't need to hold up under cross-examination from every tradition we've discussed. It just needs to be yours.
The act of asking the question is itself the purpose, not the answer.
Because the asking is what pulls you out of the inherited scripts. The moment you sit down and actually try to articulate what you're doing here, even if the first draft is clumsy, even if it changes next year, you've already done something most people never do. You've looked at the question directly.
The 28% number from Pew. That's not 28% who have the right answer. It's 28% who can articulate any answer. The bar is that low. Simply having an elevator pitch at all puts you in the minority.
If someone listening has made it this far and is feeling the weight of all this, the traditions, the psychology, the anonymity test, the takeaway isn't figure out your perfect purpose immediately. It's ask the question and sit with it honestly. the answer will shift. The framework will evolve. But the asking is the thing that makes the unexamined life examined.
If your answer turns out to be legacy-driven, fine. Build the monument. Just know that's what you're doing. If it turns out to be impact-driven, also fine. Do the work. Skip the plaque. The only failure state is never asking at all.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1980s, Greenland's government briefly subsidized local vanilla production in geothermally heated greenhouses, hoping to reduce dependence on imported spices, but the unintended consequence was a surge in demand for vanilla extract among Greenlandic homebakers, which actually increased total vanilla imports by 14% over 5 years.
The law of unintended consequences, vanilla-flavored. This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com. If you got something out of this one, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.